On January 12th, James R. Thompson will be sworn in as governor for an unprecedented fourth consecutive term. Joining me to talk about his next 4 years in office is Governor Thompson. Welcome.
Hi. I'm back. Oh, no, not him again, right?
What's it going to be like to be sworn in for the fourth time?
I'm not really sure. I have very strong memories of the first inaugural, as you might expect, because I was the brand new kid on the block. I was the rookie governor in the United States, and now I'm going to be the senior governor in the United States. And I have memories of the other two. I'm hoping it will be really exciting. I think it will be. More than historic, I hope people will look upon it as a new beginning for Illinois, and that we'll have in this administration and in the state, in the business, in the labor, in the public, in the private sector, a sense of excitement and vitality that we really need to compete and keep up with our brother and sister states and with the rest of the world.
Is this fourth swearing-in going to be different in many regards from the second or the third?
Oh, the basics are usually the same. You know, I'm sworn in. It's not my inaugural. It's our inaugural. The governor assumes the responsibility for organizing it, but the other constitutional officers will be sworn in, and the trustees of the University of Illinois will be sworn in, and there will be the associated events, the religious service on Monday morning at the First Presbyterian Church in Springfield, and the open house at the mansion and the ball, as well as the ceremony itself and some receptions and dinners. But it'll be a little bit different than last time. Different musical groups will play. There'll be different performers. Bobby Short is coming from New York, back to Illinois. The Danville native returns to Illinois. And that was really a very touching thing. My wife and I were in New York for a weekend a couple of weeks ago, and we saw his show, and we've been going there for the last, 10 years, I guess. And he came over and asked when the inaugural was, and I said, January 12th. And he said, well, why don't you invite me to play? And I said, you're invited. And he said he wanted to do it for me. He's from Illinois, and he's proud of that. He's a member of the Lincoln Academy, or laureate of the Lincoln Academy, and so he'll play. And the Springfield Symphony is doing a special concert. I think that's really great. So it should be a nice weekend.
Have you written your inaugural speech yet?
No. I've seen, two drafts are on my desk from two different authors, and now I've got to look at them and then decide how much of it I'm going to write and how much of it will be written by the speechwriters. It's varied over the years. My first one was written entirely by someone else. My second and third were written by me. The third one was actually mostly Henry Horner, because the state was in the same position in 1983 that it was in 1933, almost. Not quite as bad, but, the theme was the same. But we're in a different position now. Difficult, but not the same as 4 years ago. And so I'll decide later this week who will write the speech.
Are you going to have a major theme? Is it going to be a look at the future?
Well, it'll be a futuristic speech, but it won't contain a great deal of detail. Most inaugural speeches are very short. Governor Blanchard's in Michigan the other day was 9 minutes. And they should be short. An inaugural speech should strike a note, maybe two, and that's it. Because you've got the State of the State coming up in February, and that's the agenda for the year. You've got the budget coming up in March, and that's the agenda for this coming year as well. So the State of the State and the budget speech are really the proper vehicles for what we expect to happen in Illinois in 1987 and maybe 1988. The inaugural should be a little more futuristic. I may talk about the next decade, since I've had the experience of the last decade. Doesn't mean I'm going to be here another 20 or 10 years, but I think more and more the responsibility of a governor is not only to act as the chief executive on the problems of today, but to plan for the future. And there are a lot of things that need to be done now, to be put in place now, so that the governor in 1997 has a better chance than I had to deal with what will confront Illinois a decade from now.
In preparing to plan for the future, You've set up a transition team. How much of what the transition team proposes will we see you implement in coming years?
Well, I looked at their suggested themes that they brought to me the other day, and I agreed not only with all of them, but I even agreed with the priority in which they had ranked them. So you'll hear a little bit of it in the inaugural address. You'll hear much more of it in the State of the State. And you'll hear it in speeches around the state for the balance of this year. And it'll be more than a single year's program. I mean, if I'm going to be talking about a transportation program, that may be a one-year proposal with a five-year payoff. If I'm talking about education and the changing of an economy, that may be a 10-year agenda. If I'm talking about tax reform in Illinois, that may be a 2-year agenda. So depending on the subject, the job will take anywhere from 6 months to 2-3 years.
You've been in office 10 years, and I was wondering whether after 10 years you think it's time to reorganize state government.
Well, I've never been afraid of reorganization, and I've done a fair amount year by year. The only real issue that's been raised is whether or not you ought to do something different in human services, whether you ought to go to a more centralized administration of human services. And I don't really have any strong feelings about that. I'm not sure a super secretary of human services as opposed to the individual departments of mental health and public aid and DCFS and DOERS and others would deliver services more efficiently, or whether a compromise with a Secretary of Human Services having some overall policy and meshing responsibilities and then individual departments and directors under him would make sense, or whether we just leave things alone and use the cabinet as a coordinating mechanism. I'm not sure. I think the people in the place are more important than the mechanical structure. There's no doubt that human services need to be more coordinated. I think I agree with that concept. And there will be a theme in the inaugural of going to preventive services in the next decade rather than reactive services. I think there's a great deal of validity, for example, in the notion that has been expressed by some of the individual directors, Ann Kiley at Mental Health and Mike Lane at Corrections, that oftentimes by the time they see their clients, it's too late. If the next decade is to be a decade of prevention, and an attempt to break a poverty or a welfare cycle, or to break a cycle of ignorance for poor children, or poor health for poor children, then a great deal more coordination of state human services, along with the community human services, needs to be put in place. How you achieve that is the real question, and whether that can be achieved by the right people, whether that can be achieved by a stronger role for the governor's office, whether that takes a Department of Human Services with sub-departments is something that I really haven't had answered for me. But I don't think you'll see a great deal of reorganization. I prefer to take it step by step as I have for a decade. I'm not a fan of reorganization just to make a lot of noise and fanfare.
In early December, you were stopped from getting into your limousine in Springfield by a couple of people who wanted to talk to you about cost of living increases for welfare recipients. And at that time, you indicated that the whole welfare system needed to be restructured. Is this what you're talking about with the human service?
Partly. The federal government's now indicated a willingness to be more flexible and to let the states experiment in how we deliver public assistance, and we'll certainly be leaders both in Illinois and Washington and making that come true. I mean, the present welfare system is, I think, an unholy mess for everybody. It costs the taxpayers billions. Recipients are largely unsatisfied. They want more money. We don't have it. Simply giving them more money may ease people's lives, but if those lives are to continue to be spent on the welfare rolls rather than as working members of society, they'll never be eased to anybody's satisfaction, whether it's taxpayer or recipient or governor or legislator. I mean, so you're dealing with two problems. You're dealing with a long-term public assistance policy and what it should do and how can it be most structured to make public assistance what it was originally designed to be, and that is a temporary bridge between jobs rather than a way of life. If you're dealing with it as a way of life, it's going to be a failure from the start, by definition. And we've got to get away from this way of life notion, not only because it's destructive to the people who are born on and live in welfare as a way of life, and that's an inhuman sort of thing, it seems to me, but it's so enormously expensive. I mean, if you were just spending a quarter of the dollars that we spend on public assistance in education or in health services or public works projects or in stimulating employment, we could do extraordinary things in this state. And secondly, there never will be enough money for the welfare grant itself to satisfy the advocacy groups. I mean, there just won't. And so long as welfare is viewed as a way of life, that is certainly so. And so while it's difficult for me to explain to people, whether it's in the Capitol or picketers around my house in Chicago, and I've had both, that there is no money at the moment for an increase in the flat grant. And while it's difficult to explain to a group of religious leaders in my office in Chicago or in a phone call from the Cardinal, and I've had both, that it's not just the dollars in the flat grant, but you have to count in food stamps and energy assistance and free medical care. In fact, medical care of a variety and quality that a lot of working people can't afford and don't get. But to be told by somebody, as I was told by a woman outside the Capitol, that if we didn't increase the welfare grant in Illinois, a lot of our recipients would move to Wisconsin because they get more money there. And as my eyebrows started to move up on that one, since that's the first time that line's been tried on me, she said, and then you'll lose all that tax revenue.
Some would say that's not losing any tax revenue.
Well, what she meant was that welfare recipients spend almost all of their income as disposable income, and there's sales tax revenue from that, and there certainly is. But that line's not going anywhere with me. I mean, that's as persuasive to me as coming to picket my house in Christmas week is. I mean, there is a time and place to make a rational argument for an increase in the welfare grant, which I agree with, and if I had the money, I'd do it today. But threatening to move doesn't move me, and picketing my house when I have an office doesn't move me either. I mean, I just turn off at that. So we'll work our way through it. But I think really the long-term answer is we've got to get away from a system which views welfare as a way of life, because that's a destructive thing for everybody.
That's what Project Chance was designed to do.
Right.
Has it been successful?
Project Chance, I think, has been successful. It is moving people off the welfare rolls and on to employment roles, although that too is expensive. Money has to be invested in Project Chance before it can pay off. And there are long-term pilot projects in the private sector, the Beethoven Project that's going to be run in the Robert Taylor Homes with some state assistance, but with some private assistance too, is an attempt to take youngsters preschool who would otherwise just be automatically destined for the welfare rolls and to try and turn their lives around in a specific public housing project in a specific city, specific group of kids, to see if that can work too. So there will be a lot of people working both in and out of government over the next year or so. My guess is that the revamping of the public assistance systems of the United States will occupy the attention of the nation's governors to the same extent as education has the last 3-4 years. In other words, I think the governors who were the pioneers in remaking education in their states, beginning with Governor Alexander in Tennessee and others of us, will now, without letting go of education as a priority, which it certainly is, turn our next innovative eye to the welfare problem.
Tax reform. You set up a revenue review committee headed by Doug Whitley, the president
right.
of the Taxpayers Federation. What do you want Doug's committee to do? Do you want it to come in and propose shifts in taxes, but providing a vehicle for additional revenue? Do you want it to come up and say we need to redo the sales tax because our sales taxes all messed up.
I've given him, in my conversations with him, a very broad mandate. I think it's maybe a little broader than he originally anticipated. And he does come from a background with the Taxpayers Federation, you know, and he's got his clientele there. And their attitude, in addition to being watchdogs on issues of taxes and revenues, has always been to sort of, you know, protect the interests of retailers and people like that to make sure that the system functioned mechanically. I think that the work of the commission ought to be broadened, maybe even the membership of the commission ought to be broadened, and they ought to take a run at full-scale tax reform for Illinois in time to be presented to this session, this upcoming spring session of the General Assembly, though my guess is it will probably take, if we make this a major focus of the legislative session, as I would like to do, it's maybe a two-year project, not just a single-year project. I'd be surprised if we could do it all in 1 year. I mean, the time is right. Not only is it the beginning of a new administration in the executive branch and a new legislature, but it's been almost 20 years since there was a major tax change in Illinois. We've had a lot of tax reform in Illinois over the last 10 years, and I'm very proud of that. And we've had a lot of tax relief in Illinois over the last 10 years, and I'm very proud of that. Our tax system today is more equitable than it was on the day when I became governor, and our tax system today is less onerous than it was on the day I became governor, and those are significant accomplishments. But the question that bothers me is, does our tax system reflect the economy of 1987 in the state of Illinois, or does it reflect the economy of 20 years ago? And they're two very different economies. And how will it treat the economy of Illinois 10 years from now? My belief is that a tax system, to be fair, is one which reflects today's and tomorrow's economic realities, not yesterday's economic realities. Takes the least amount of money from the most people to deliver needed governmental services, and doesn't hit one group disproportionately, doesn't leave anybody out, and is not only fair but is viewed as fair. Now, I think every once in a while, maybe every 10 or 20 years, you've got to sit down and look at your whole system from beginning to end, even though you've made considerable year-by-year progress in the last 10 years, to make sure that it reflects the economy of today and tomorrow, and to make sure that it is fair from beginning to end, and it is proportionate as it can be, and that it's at the right rate for what you want to be done, and that it takes account of other things that have happened, federal tax reform, for example. It should take account of what's happened there. Even if we don't want to follow their exact path, we've got to recognize the reality of that and at least treat with it.
Are you talking about perhaps tax shifting, increasing the income tax and decreasing the sales taxes?
Well, I'm certain that'll be looked at simply because it's been suggested. I mean, Comptroller Burris has suggested that we increase the income tax and decrease the sales tax simply on the grounds of federal deductibility. Now that he's raised the issue, we'll all look at that. I'm not persuaded that you should make tax policy simply for the purpose of federal deductibility. That can be a consideration. But that's one thing I'm sure that the commission will, I hope they will, consider. It's a matter of public debate now. It's been a matter of debate in the editorial columns, and so it's certainly appropriate. I'm sure they'll look at the idea of extending the sales tax to the services. And we were more of a service economy than we were 20 years ago, so that's certainly a subject for consideration because that would reflect more economic reality than our present system. An extension to services and a lowering of the rate could be considered a trade-off. And there are all sorts of tax trade-offs. Now, this is a very difficult area because those people who are not now taxed don't want to be. Those people who are taxed don't want to be. Everybody would like the lowest possible rate. Everybody wants the highest possible services.
It's a no-win situation.
It's a win situation, but it's a difficult. It's not an easy thing. It's not as easy as saying, hey, raise the income tax, lower the sales tax, and make those who deduct on their income tax happy. I mean, there's more involved than that. There's a whole huge state to deliver services to. I mean, how much money does education take? you know, and what are we going to do with welfare, and can we count on taking some money from the welfare budget 5 years from now and putting it into education, you know, or can we not? I don't know. So all these things are interrelated. That's all I'm saying. It's a much more complex thing than the comptroller's single suggestion. It's a much more complex issue than, for example, the Farm Bureau has advanced in the past when they've said raise the state income tax and lower property taxes for the support of public schools. I mean, that's an interesting idea. Maybe it can be achieved, maybe it can't be. But if it's going to be looked at, it ought to be looked at in the context of a whole overview of Illinois' tax structure. And for a lot of reasons, this is the time.
Haven't we had other studies done on the state's tax structure?
Yes, we have. I commissioned one several years ago, and maybe a third of their recommendations were enacted, and another third were proposed by me and not passed by the legislature, and another third weren't acted on. So there was a commission, and there was a considerable amount of achievement from the commission. There was debate of the rest of the agenda, and the time has come to do it again.
What about a gas tax? During the recent campaign, you talked about the potential need to increase the state's gas taxes.
I certainly did, and on more than one occasion. And it got my press staff all excited, my campaign manager all excited, but I said, hey, people aren't stupid. If they want roads and highways built, new ones. If they want present roads extended, if they want all our roads kept in good repair, we have to pay for that somehow. We had a road program proposed in 1983. That's 4 years ago. It was a five-year program. Simple arithmetic would tell you it's time to start considering a new transportation program, and it's one of the things that I'm giving thought to. I haven't come to any final conclusions yet, but we need a new road program in Illinois. It's an important part of our infrastructure. It's our single greatest competitive advantage in the competition for jobs, to be able to deliver goods and services by our system of integrated transportation. And that's more than highways. I mean, that includes airports and water transportation and rail transportation. It's one of the things that's a big plus, a selling factor for Illinois, and it's time to turn our attention to that. So I will have a transportation program proposal for the legislature this year.
Presumably, will we see that during the State of the State?
I would guess. Or in a special message.
In a special message. What do you want? I'm going to shift focus to some personal things now. What do you want historians to remember your administration for? You've got four more years to at least four more years, if not longer, to do some additional things as the state's chief executive. What do you want your administration to be known for?
Well, I suppose several things. I want the administration to be known as honest and competent. I think those are bottom line touchstones. I think it is known as honest and competent. I want to be remembered as an entrepreneurial governor for having built things, and not just structures, although I'm proud of the structures. I'm proud of this building, the State of Illinois Center in Chicago. I'm proud of that. Despite all the controversy, I'm very proud of the McCormick Place extension. Because now the articles are starting to say, gee, isn't it great to have this building? Gee, isn't it great to retain the leadership in the convention business for North America? This is a wonderful hall. All the favorable articles are now starting to come out. And I took all the heat for the unfavorable ones, but you got to have some vision about what this state needs and be willing to get it done. I want to get that stadium built for the White Sox. I want to help the Bears in an appropriate way. I want to get the racing facilities rebuilt. There are still things that are needed in Springfield. So I want to be remembered for having added to the infrastructure of this state, though I don't have any what we call the edifice complex. But I want to be remembered for an entrepreneurial infrastructure, too. I want to be remembered as the governor who was governor at a pivotal time in the state's economic life and who helped direct the state from one economy to another. I'm proud to build Illinois. I want to be remembered as a governor who ushered in a new era of relationships between Illinois state government and local governments, and that's going to be a theme of both the inaugural and the next administration. But that doesn't mean, as many mayors assume, that I'm simply going to shovel money at them that the federal government is not shoveling anymore, because we don't have any more than the federal government has. I mean, I read an editorial the other day in a Business Weekly that suggested, without any real foundation, that we could easily take our so-called tax windfall that we're going to receive as a result of federal tax reform and give it to local government, and then increase revenue sharing from 1/12 to 1/11 of the income tax. That's only $30 million more, though they didn't say where it was coming from, and everybody would be happy. Well, baloney. We don't have that kind of money, and we have responsibilities in state government, whether it's mental health or education or corrections or human services of one kind or another. And money isn't the answer to everything. But just as there is a new day coming fast in the relationship between federal and state governments, we have to look again at the relationship between state and local governments. Maybe some services can be delivered better in local communities by local communities. So maybe dollar shifting is something we ought to be looking at. Now, that won't come easy either, because there exist different levels of competence out there in the communities of Illinois, different levels of experience and ability. There will be powerful protectors of the turf in state government and existing bureaucracies and institutions who say, no, we can deliver better from Springfield. But I think that just as the time is ripe for an overall look at tax reform, the time is ripe, too, to reassess the relationships between state government and local government for the next 10 years and decide who can deliver most compassionately and efficiently governmental services without regard to a lot of selfishness or turf battles about who gets to do what or who has to pay for what. In the end, it's the same recipient of services. It's the same taxpayer. Mayors and governors are instruments of the taxpayer. We sometimes get looked upon, even by ourselves, as, you know, the big deal, and it's a contest between a governor and a mayor to see who can get the dollars and who can deliver the service and who can get the credit. The taxpayer doesn't really care about that. It's the taxpayer's dollars, and it's the taxpayer citizen welfare that we're looking at, and that should be the prime focus, how you can best deliver the services. We know who's going to pay for them in the end. We're all going to pay for them in the end.
One last question. Was this recent election your last campaign?
I have no idea.
Have you any thoughts about running for governor in 4 more years?
I've got a single electoral thought of any kind in my head, and I shouldn't have.
Do you have any? There are many who question your aspirations for a position in Washington.
I know. But that thought's not in my head either. I mean, I got a big job to do here, and I've just outlined a very ambitious agenda for 1987, haven't I? And it can't be done from a motel room in New Hampshire, I don't think.
Or Iowa?
Not if it's going to be done very well, or even from Iowa.
Okay. Thank you very much. You've been listening to an interview with Governor James Thompson that was conducted in his Chicago office in the State of Illinois Center. I'm Mary Frances Fagan.